First case, 24-9534, Nava Kapila versus Bondi. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. This is Ricardo Figueroa on behalf of the petitioner. If I may, I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal, if that is possible. I don't think I have a very long presentation today, but just in case I run out of time, I'd like to reserve that time for rebuttal, Your Honors.
Sure thing, counsel. We'll just ask you to keep an eye on your time, and when you get to a point where you want to sit down, if we don't have any questions, we'll accommodate that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. If I may, please, the court, Your Honors.
Please.
Thank you. The petition for review today is one in which there is a jurisdictional issue at stake, even at this juncture in the proceedings. And that is that the petitioner did not file his petition for review within 30 days of the date of the last decision of the Board of Appeals, Board of Immigration Appeals. And the reason for that is, factually, the reason is that the notice was received too late for that to be effectively presented to the
court. What was it really received too late? He did receive it, and he still had some days after that to respond, did he not, before the deadline?
Yes, Your Honors. That is correct.
So, I mean, he had almost 10 days. So it's unfortunate that our U.S. mail does this to people, but you can't say that he received it too late because he did have time.
I have to agree with that, Your Honor. Absolutely.
All right.
The problem here, if I may, Your Honor. Sorry.
No. Oh, of course. No, you go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. The problem here is that although there were some time, I mean, like, I think it's 13 days or so.
Yeah.
It's still available. The petitioner did not have the full 30 days to be more expedient in the matter. The petition for review was filed within the 30 days from the date in which was actually received, you know. And I mean, there are some, I guess, logistic and other problems that had to be dealt with in a shorter period of time, whereas everybody else who gets the notice really right after it's been issued, they would not have that kind of situation to resolve.
Well, let me ask you this. So the document that had to be filed was sort of a summary form document. It's not like you had to have an opening brief or something filed within 10 days, right?
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so and he was represented by counsel at the time that the notice was sent out.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I was the attorney of record in the appeal to the BIA. However, I was not being retained yet as for the 10th Circuit, Your Honor, appeal. So
okay.
I had to be retained, and I mean, or he could have retained somebody else.
I mean, you received a copy of the decision.
I did receive a copy of the decision, Your Honor. I think it was on the 17th day. I think I don't recall the month at this moment.
Right. No, that's fine. I mean, the record will show that. I was just let me ask you a different question. So if it turns out that this is a jurisdictional statute as opposed to a claims processing rule, whether you got it with 10 days to go or whether you got it with 30 days to go, it wouldn't make any difference. Do you agree with that?
I mean, what's... I think it would make a little difference.
Let me ask you a different question.
Yes.
So would you contend that tolling would apply if this was a jurisdictional statute?
I think it would.
Okay. Go ahead and tell me why you think that.
Well, because, you know, the notice of the decision by the BIA is similar to what it is a notice of entry of judgment in a civil matter, for example. And when the notice of the civil matter is not actually served and received by the other party on time, then that other party, if he acts, you know, in a diligent manner and tries to file as soon as possible and does that without causing any delay or prejudice to the other party, then normally, equitable tolling may apply. Might be that many other requirements must be listed, Your Honors.
But did your client ever argue there were unusual or extenuating circumstances that prevented the, I mean, did your client ever express what diligent efforts he did engage in during the time frame?
Well, Your Honor, if I may, my client is is an unsophisticated person, you know. And in his view of life and things around him, he did everything he could to do it faster and efficiently and not try to delay in any
way. But there's nothing in the record that shows steps he did take during that 10 or 12 days that he had that could be determined to be diligent efforts. We just don't know. There's nothing that shows what he did or didn't do.
I guess, Your Honor, that is true in the sense that the record is devoid of that information. That's an absolute truth, I believe. It can be implied that he tried to hire counsel, get somebody, and actually have that petition for review filed, even though it was not filed within the specific time that the statute would require in a normal...
You say it could be implied, but there's nothing in the evidence that showed he was trying to hire counsel or who he tried to hire or why or any... The record is silent about all of that.
That is true, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The record is devoid of that information. That is absolutely true.
Counsel, yes, could I just ask if the petitioner needed more than 10 days, could a request for extra time have been made? In other words, requested for a continuance or a moving the deadline back, could that request have been made during that time?
Your Honor, if I understood correctly, you're asking if he knew there was not enough time, that whether a motion for a continuance to file the...
That's my question. Is that a procedural option?
It could have been that, Your Honor. The thing is that rather than waiting on or filing a new motion, what the petitioner did was to file the actual petition for review, although a little bit late. But many of the cases that talk about that issue, they notice that the petitioner in those cases, took months or even some years sometimes, to actually file the petition for review of a decision that took place so long ago. And in this matter, we're talking about purely some days, not a very long time to say that he sat on his rights rather than pursuing them or trying to pursue those rights, Your Honor.
And I'll just ask a question about an argument you have in your brief. As I understand it, one of the arguments you're making is that the 30 days should run from the service of the order as opposed to after the order of removal has been entered. If I'm understanding that argument correctly, how would we have the authority to do that?
Well,
the time under the statute starts when the order of removal is entered. And if I'm reading the brief correctly, you're suggesting, well, it really should run from the date of service. And how would this court be in a position to adopt your position?
Your Honor, in response, I can say that usually the purpose of serving a notice or serving a lawsuit on anybody is to give it some time for the person to actually be able to respond to the lawsuit. In this case, on a notice of a judgment, which is what, in essence, the Board of Immigration Appeals did, you should have time to respond from the moment it's being served on you, because otherwise, like in this case where you get it like sometime later, then the problem is you don't have enough time to respond to it appropriately or in the best manner possible according to your circumstances. It's like asking somebody on a civil matter to respond to a lawsuit because the lawsuit is being filed, but it hasn't been served. Or when you have an appeal from the judgment to request or force the appellant to file his appeal before he knows that a judgment is being entered. Kind of thing, Your Honor. I believe that in a plain due process situation, you have to be given notice so you have the time to respond to the judgment that has been entered.
Counsel, what I'm getting at is wouldn't that require an amendment of the statute, the 1252B1 statute?
Well, in general terms, it does, because the statute speaks about that. But then when you look at the situation, to avoid any cutting of rights or due process procedural rights of somebody, I think that it's implied that you get notice before you are forced to respond, even in the situation of this kind of statute. Because it really isn't the responsibility of the person to receive them. I mean, let me strike that out because I'm going the wrong way. No, what I'm trying to say is that it's really the responsibility of the board, in this case, to have immediately put that on the mail so that the respondent in that case gets the notice with enough time to be able to file his response or his appeal to the circuit.
Are you able to monitor the BIA website or any kind of electronic filing in the BIA to determine the status of your cases?
Your Honor, that's a great question. I think there is something called the ICAS now, but not all the cases are working under the ICAS yet. In this case, it's an old case that it's, I believe, going under the old system where you don't get anything on the internet. You cannot be checking on it.
So you file everything in paper form with the BIA?
I believe this is a case that you do it on paper alone. I think so, you know.
Okay.
Because it's an old case. This is coming from probably 8-10 years ago, you know. The new case is all, you know, kind of go through the new ECAS system, and it's very easy to monitor them. Yeah, and it's very expedient as well.
Okay. Judge Matheson?
Nothing further from
Judge
me.
Okay, we'll let you have the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Well,
unless you want to keep going, it's up to you. You
can before the court today.
You can keep going if you want to.
But it will eat into you.
But you won't have any rebuttal.
You just have a minute and 20 seconds.
Oh, I got it. I just would like to state, Your Honors, if I may, that on the merits of the case, we have another situation. And I think is that the definition as applied of what a serious, particular serious crime is, is also defective. And although I don't have time to address it right now, just want to put it on the record, if I may. And that's all, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Greg Kelch, representing the United States Attorney General. In 1995, the Supreme Court in Stone v. INS held that the filing deadline for an immigration petition is mandatory and jurisdictional and not subject to equitable tolling. And this court has followed that in its own precedential cases.
Is that true? even in extremes. I mean, let's say there was a postal strike, and for 30 days, everybody knew that nothing was going to be delivered through the postal services. Would that still get people out of luck because they didn't get their notice in time? I mean, do we have absolutely no authority, in your opinion, to extend that 30 days?
That is correct. And so because of how harsh that is, it does seem like we should have a remedy to that. And as we've noted in our briefs, there is a remedy. He can go back to the Board of Immigration Appeals and he can file a motion to reissue that decision.
He can do that?
He can do that.
Can he do it now?
Yes, Your Honor, he can. And he can seek judicial review of that, as you've done before. The case slips my mind. And you have done that before in unpublished cases. You've heard petitions for review of people seeking a motion to reissue from the BIA. And if he wishes to do that, that would really be the forum for him to raise this claim that he has about he didn't receive his mail.
And what is the standard that the BIA has set forth for their willingness to grant a motion to reissue?
It is for an abuse of discretion, but in the hypothetical that you are describing, where somebody is absolutely unable to seek judicial review that Congress intended for them to have, I think he probably would have a petitioner would have a strong argument that, hey, that's an abuse of discretion, that the agency is not letting me get my judicial review. I can't imagine the BIA would deny a motion like that. What we have here, though, is he's claiming that he didn't receive the mail. And, you know, with respect, before we blame the BIA, I do have to wonder if perhaps this mail got lost in his office. Remember that his client was also sent a courtesy copy of the decision. We don't have any explanation about what was the client doing. And then just in addition to that, I just do want to remind the court that, you know, there's a 16-day gap. It's 16 days between when he says he received it on April 7th and when he filed it and when it would have been due on May 3rd. You have electronic filing in this circuit. It's not a hard thing to file the petition. I personally am surprised that the client and his attorney were not discussing this, because the arguments they were making before the agency are all foreclosed. His particularly serious crime argument, it's all foreclosed by this court's decision in Al-Salehi. So he should have known that he probably wasn't going to win before the agency and would have to seek further review. But if I can just redirect to the point that I wanted to make as I flew out here from Washington, D.C., about this phrase, mandatory and jurisdictional and not subject to equitable tolling, that's the law. That's the precedent from the Supreme Court and from this court. This is an untimely petition. All that we are trying to make clear through our filings is that in more recent years, the Supreme Court has cautioned courts and practitioners that we should all be more mindful in how we use the term jurisdiction, because, of course, that term refers to your adjudicatory authority over the subject matter and over the person. And recently in Santos Zacharias, which is a case about the exhaustion bar, but in that case, the Supreme Court noted this language from Stone v. INS. And the Supreme Court did say that Stone did not attend to the distinction between jurisdictional rules as we understand them today and non-jurisdictional but mandatory ones. And so the only point that we're trying to make through our filings is just the way that you should characterize this, dispose of this untimely petition, should be through a summarily deny a petition rather than to dismiss a petition, as our understanding is that that's the proper language to be using at this juncture. But to be clear, our position is that this is still mandatory and equitable tolling does not apply. That part of Stone still applies, and that part of this court's precedential decision still applies. It's just not subject to equitable tolling.
Counsel, could I just ask you about your reading of this? Of course, we've got the Riley case. It's going to be argued, what, next Monday?
It is, Your Honor.
All right, so we've got that kind of in the background, or maybe more in the foreground. If 1252b1 is a claim processing rule, tell me again, why isn't it subject to equitable tolling?
Well, first reason is that Stone, the Supreme Court, and this court in its published decisions have held that that is not subject to equitable tolling.
Well, let me let me just stop you there for 1 second. Stone and Gonzalez Alcaron used the terms jurisdiction and not subject to equitable tolling separately, didn't they? Why isn't a better reading that they were talking about the relationship between equitable tolling and jurisdiction? Because equitable tolling doesn't apply to jurisdiction, but if we move into the realm of claim processing, why isn't equitable tolling available?
Well, if you read equitable tolling as modifying jurisdictional, as you just said, that wouldn't make any sense because jurisdictional rules are not subject to equitable tolling.
Well, so, why wouldn't it make sense? It's just the court reminding everyone that equitable tolling doesn't apply to jurisdiction. Why wouldn't that make perfect sense for the court to say that?
Well, because it would render the term mandatory just a nullity. Like, why would the Supreme Court have said that mandatory and jurisdictional, not subject to equitable tolling?
Well,
they could have just said jurisdiction.
Mandatory, the word mandatory is there, but there's nothing about claim processing at this point. So why isn't that up for grabs? Why isn't, if it is a claim processing rule, I take it your position is that it's a mandatory claim processing rule as opposed to a non-mandatory claim processing rule. But why is that a settled question when we still have to hear from the court in Riley?
Well, so we do not object to the court waiting until the Supreme Court
issues
its decision.
I'm not asking that question. I'm just saying, is it still an open question?
Our position is it is not, respectfully. As I've said, our position would be that equitable tolling modifies the term mandatory. And so that all that this does is it says all that we're saying here is that it's mandatory and not subject to equitable tolling. And when the Supreme Court used the word jurisdictional in 1995, they weren't using that term the way they use it today. They were talking about it's mandatory and not subject to equitable tolling.
Well, they used the word jurisdiction then. I just don't think you can ignore that.
Well, I mean, respectfully, our position is that it's mandatory and not subject to equitable tolling.
I understand your argument, but it seems to me that there's room for some debate.
So if it is an open question, then I guess the next question would be, why shouldn't equitable tolling apply here? And to that, we would refer the court to Federal Appellate Procedure 26B2. You can't extend the time to file a petition for review unless specifically authorized by law. So in Nutraceutical Corporation, the Supreme Court looked at Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure 23F, I believe it was, and that Supreme Court held that Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure does not allow for equitable tolling. I think that would apply here. I also would refer the court back to Stone v. INS, not just the sentence that we keep harping on, but if you look overall to the logic of Stone, what the Supreme Court was explaining was that Congress created a statutory scheme that they intended to have expedited adjudication of these cases. They want the final order of removal to come in, and they want a petition for review right away. And if there's a motion to reopen, then you'll just add that in to whatever petition for review is part of the court. And I think that also counsels towards the idea that as a mandatory claims processing rule now, Congress did not intend for there to be equitable tolling for that filing deadline.
Do you have a position on if this case is subject to equitable tolling, despite all of your arguments why it's not, why it is or is not a good candidate for equitable tolling?
Your Honor, we believe strongly that this is a very poor candidate for equitable tolling. First of all, there's no actual evidence here of when that document was received. And so again, as I was saying to Judge Ebel, the better course of action would be for him to seek reissuance before the BIA, submit his evidence. The BIA can also check its logs of when it was sent out to see if there's some problem here. That's the first problem. Second problem is that he still had, it's actually 16 days, there's 30 days in April. So between April 17th, when he says he received it, and May 3rd, he still had 16 days to file that. Equitable tolling is not a briefing extension. Equitable tolling covers a period where someone is prevented from filing because of an extraordinary circumstance. And then last, as I said, it's sort of odd that he wouldn't have had a plan to go even before the BIA issued its decision, because, I mean, his argument is foreclosed by a matter of Carabel and by this court's decision in Al-Salehi. So, you know, any relief that he was going to receive, it would have to be through this court. So we contend it's a very poor candidate for equitable tolling.
Counsel, could you just explain something you said a few minutes ago? I think you said that the proper disposition would be summary denial as opposed to dismissal. Could you explain that?
Well, my understanding of those two terms is you dismiss a petition when you lack jurisdiction over it, and you summarily deny a petition when you have jurisdiction, but there are not facts and arguments of substance for the court to issue a decision on the merits. And that's my understanding of the semantics. Again, we were not trying to set off a bomb with our commentary about what the term jurisdictional means.
Before you go further, will you say that again? About the summary denial versus dismissal?
My understanding of that language is that you dismiss a petition when you lack jurisdiction over it, and you summarily deny a petition for review when you have jurisdiction, but there are not substantial arguments for the court to rule on.
Well, I thought you said you propose we deny. Did I get that wrong? You're proposing that we dismiss and not deny?
Summarily deny.
Which do you think, if we bought your argument, do we dismiss or deny according to your standard?
Deny.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it's an untimely petition.
That's what I thought. That's what I understood you to say originally. Just now I understood you to say it to the contrary, so I must have misunderstood you.
Okay. Pardon me. So if there are no further questions, I don't know if the court wants me to address the merits of the case substantively. We certainly are happy to stand on our briefs. Particularly serious crime bar does not have a provision for rehabilitation. And this case probably is a good demonstration of why. He was convicted back in 2013. DHS put him into removal proceedings right away. The case has just dragged on for 10 years. So when the United Nations was coming up with this concept of particularly serious crime, they probably thought people would be removed in a very expeditious fashion and didn't realize people would still be here for 10 years and then arguing for, hey, in those intervening years, I'm now rehabilitated. But the intention of the statute, as this court explained on its own in Al-Salehi, is that it's the crime itself, the conviction, that is what makes the person removable from our country.
So this is not a new, unusual situation. The delay just dumbfounds me. And it's not because, I take it, the record doesn't say it's because he was unavailable or had gone underground or couldn't be found. It just, they didn't do anything. They just let it sit there.
It's not that we didn't do anything. It's that there was, you know, he went through some counsels, he fired a counsel. There was some counsels who didn't return his phone calls and weren't diligent. There was also an in absentia removal order where counsel had misadvised him of when to show up, and that required a BIA appeal, and it came down, and then the immigration judge was detailed.
So there was activity.
There was activity. Yes, Your Honor. I don't want to fault the petitioner for that. The case moved forward, just moved forward very slowly.
All right. Thank you.
Counsel, there's no further questions.
I have one more for you. If we find that the petitioner has not shown a basis for equitable tolling, wouldn't that alone call for dismissal or denial, as the case may be? But wouldn't that dispose of this matter?
Yes, absolutely. Our position is that this is just a conversation about how the court is going to draft its order disposing of this petition for review, because it seems to us that there's just no way that the court should be hearing this untimely petition. If you insist that you want to call it a dismissal, may I continue?
Oh, please.
If you want to, you know, it's dismissed for lack of jurisdiction in accordance with your precedent, you can do that. We're just trying to be the fair dealers here and explain that our understanding of the language is that it should now be denied and not dismissed. And that was our only point to make today. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You have 45 seconds if you'd like it, sir.
If I may, sorry. I just want to address the issue of the refiling of a motion to get a new notice of the decision of the BIA. The problem with that is that there is no remedy. You know, in this case, you will get a new notice with the same date of the decision of the BIA. So why would that make a difference?
Well, but it would be, you would file your petition for review based on the date of issuance, right? Of the new notice.
The new notice will contain the same date of the decision, which I believe is that what is the operative date.
I understood that the BIA would give you a new date of decision when you applied for it with cause. I expect BIA would require cause, but have you ever done that? Are you familiar with that process?
Never done that, Your Honor, but I read the CFR that talks about it, and it doesn't say that it's going to give you a new notice, a new date of notice. It's just going to give, it's going to give you a new date of notice, not a new date of decision. So there is no remedy, so there is no exhaustion to be done there, because you can only do it when you can do it by to claim a remedy as of right, not as a discretionary matter.
Okay. Thank you, Counselor. You're out of time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be submitted and Counselor excused.